We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids podcast from the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, known as ACAM. Have you ever wondered how a child's ability to manage their emotions and impulses might shape their later mental health? And what if one of the most important predictors isn't really about how clever they are, but how well regulated they are on the inside? Today's episode explores the important role that self-regulation plays in children's emotional and behavioural development, and what this can tell us about their later mental health. Hi, I'm Mark Tebbs. I'm your host for today. I spent my whole career working in mental health, from frontline service delivery to director of mental health commissioning. I'm currently a chief executive charity, and I'm a trustee of a mental health organisation and also a career coach. I'm really pleased to be hosting these podcasts. It gives me the opportunity to speak to some of the kind of leading clinicians and academics in the kind of forefront of children and young people's mental health. So if you're a clinician, if you're an educator, a parent, or just curious about mental health, I hope these discussions leave you with some fresh insights and practical tools to help. Don't forget to subscribe where you get your podcast from, and also on your YouTube channel, just search ACAMH and you'll find us across all socials. I'm delighted to be joined by Lilia Jontortag from the Uppsala University, whose research looks at early inhibitory control and emotional regulation as predictors of internalizing and externalizing problems in childhood. We'll be discussing what those terms mean in practice, what her longitudinal study found, and why emotional regulation may be such a meaningful and important area for future research and intervention. So let's get started. Welcome, Lilia. It's an absolute pleasure to be speaking with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. Look, let's start with just some introductions. It'd be great to understand a little bit more about you, maybe kind of what your research interests are, and there's a chance to just give a little bit of a name check of the people that you worked with on this paper. So yeah, over to you.
Yeah. So my name is Lilia Jonsdottir, and we are recording this in April, and I'm currently a PhD student here at the Department of Psychology at Uppsala University in Sweden. And when this comes out, I will be a postdoctoral researcher in child and adolescent psychiatry here at the Department of Medical Sciences at Uppsala University. So I have been focusing on self-regulation development in my PhD and working with a supervisor named Karin Brocki. So Professor Karin Brocki is also one of the co-authors on this paper. And then I have my co-supervisors, Matilda Frick and Andreas Frick, who are both associate professors here and in at Stockholm University. And then I have Emma Heemann as a co-author also, who's a PhD student here with me.
Great stuff. So congratulations on your new post coming up shortly.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's dive in, and we'll talk a little bit more about your paper. So the paper's called Examining Early Inhibitory Control and Emotional Regulation as Predictors of Childhood Internalizing and Externalizing Problems, a Longitudinal Study. So kind of what drew you into this kind of research area?
So like I said, my PhD thesis is on the development of self-regulation, which is this ability to regulate our behaviors and emotions and our thoughts, so our cognition. So what I have been focusing on is different self-regulation skills, so how they relate to one another, so what influences their development and what they also predict during development. And what I thought was interesting when looking at these theories behind self-regulation development is that it is seen as sort of hierarchical. So we have simple regulation skills that then become integrated into more complex skills. And these also affect later outcomes. And here the idea was to look at sort of the developmental role of the simpler skill, which is inhibitory control, and see how it relates to emotion regulation, which is then maybe could be seen as a more complex regulatory skill.
Rightio. Okay. It'd be really great if you could bring that to life with like an example. What would that look like in a kind of like a child?
So do you mean what inhibitory control would look like or what the development would look like?
Yeah, just like thinking about a kind of case study to help explain it to the listeners. And when we talk about self-regulatory kind of like control, what does it look like for behavior?
I mean, one classic example that I think many people know about and relate to is the marshmallow test. So when we put something very, very tempting in front of a child and then ask them, you know, not to touch it for a while and see, are they able to sort of inhibit that sort of automatic response of going for the thing that they want? And I think that is sort of what we would refer to as one sort of aspect of inhibitory control, for example.
Okay, so it's the kind of control of natural impulses. So everyone wants to kind of grab the marshmallow, but so it's the ability to not act on that impulse.
Yeah, so kind of overriding what would be the automatic thing to do in favor of something that is more maybe adaptive in the moment or more important in the moment for your goals. So I think that is a pretty good way of explaining it.
Okay, good stuff. And then you mentioned like a hierarchy. So what does that refer to?
Yeah, so I mean, when we talk about self-regulation, we're often talking about different things. So it can be this sort of overarching ability of, just being able to regulate yourself, being able to not do something that you should not do in the moment, or be able to sort of stick to your goals and things like that. But then we also have these sort of simpler skills. So we can break down self-regulation into different skills. And maybe if we refer to it during development, then we can measure very early on things like inhibitory control. So being able to stop an automatic response, just that one part of self-regulation. So I think that is sort of the idea with the hierarchy, is that we have these more simple abilities, and things like working memory, for example, is also an example of self-regulation. So there are many different things that feed into these more broad skills.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, really clear. And then the link with kind of like outcomes, mental health issues. Could you unpack that a little bit?
Yep. So we know from previous research that there is an association between self-regulation and then later socio-emotional outcomes. So a lot of different important outcomes, both within childhood and also when we come to adulthood. So these are really important to look at. And then also, we know that these are associated with mental health outcomes. So both what we look at here in this study, internalizing and externalizing problems, but also just when you look at different mental health issues, we do know that self-regulation predicts these later on.
Okay, brilliant. And then just like a little bit kind of definition check. So internalizing and externalizing behaviors.
So we focused in this particular study on two dimensions of behavioral and social and emotional problems that we call internalizing and externalizing problems. And internalizing problems, they refer to these sort of inwardly directed problems like worrying and sadness and social withdrawal. And then we have externalizing problems, which refer to more outwardly directed problems. And that can be impulsivity, defiance, and aggression, for example.
Okay, brilliant. So this might be quite a difficult question, but if we were like meeting a group of young people today, so is anything in how they manage emotions or impulses that might kind of enter that future mental health problems?
So I think that if we look at emotion regulation, for example, if we have a child that has a lot of problems in recovering from being emotionally upset, so if we think of a child that is very angry or maybe very fearful and has issues with recovering from those emotions without a lot of support, then that could be something to look out for. So we can think of it as also difficulty with calming down independently, or also difficulty with calming down with assistance. Okay. So, and I think that also the opposite pattern of being very flat or showing very restricted emotional responses, that could also be relevant. But I think in this paper, we looked at maybe more of these emotional problems, I would say.
Okay, brilliant. So how did you go about the study? Tell us a little about your kind of, your methodology.
Oh, yeah. So this study comes from, it's part of a longitudinal project that has been going on for quite a long time here in Uppsala. So this study is called the EFFECT Project. And we've been following children from infancy here in Uppsala. And these children are currently, I think, in their like early teenage years. And for this paper, we had 94 typically developing children. So this is a community sample. And their families were followed, so both the children and their parents. And the sample is, of course, could be said to be sort of relatively socioeconomically advantaged, which is really important to keep in mind also when interpreting this study. But when the children were 4 years old, they did a task called the day-night Stroop task. So that is how we measured inhibitory control. And this is a pretty well-established task. So the children are shown pictures. So for example, they're shown a picture of a sun and they're asked to say opposite of what they see. So they see a sun and they should say night. And then they're shown a picture of a moon and they should say day. And then we ask them to do this repeatedly and we count how many times they get this right, basically. So that's how we measured inhibitory control. Mm-hmm. And then we went on to measure emotion regulation when the children were 6 years old. And that was done through parent report. So the a questionnaire called the emotion questionnaire, which is a validated Swedish measure. And we focused on regulatory abilities. So questions like, it's easy for others to calm this child down, or this child has difficulties calming themselves down. And then at 9 to 10 years, we assessed these social and emotional and behavioral problems, internalizing and externalizing problems, using the strengths and difficulties questionnaire. So we asked the parents to indicate their agreement with things like whether the child is often unhappy, depressed, or tearful, whether they're restless, overactive, or fight with other children and things like that.
Okay, brilliant. So the task at four, so of like, what's that kind of like, what's that measuring? Could you just kind of like explain that again to me? I didn't quite get it.
Yeah. So it is measuring inhibitory control. So basically it's the ability to sort of suppress this more automatic response. So when you see a picture of a sun, you would maybe as a child associate that with saying it's day. And then you would see a picture of a moon and you would associate that with saying it's night. But when we ask them to sort of play the opposite game, so we ask them to say night when they see a sun and day when they see a moon, and to try to do this repeatedly when we show them the pictures.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, so there's this test of inhibitory control at four, and then a parental self-assessment, and then a measurement of behavioral challenges at nine. And what were the kind of what were the headlines findings?
Mm-hmm. So we have two maybe most important findings that are maybe pulling us in somewhat different directions. So we have first, when we looked at this inhibitory control that we measured using the day-night task, it did not predict emotion regulation and it did not predict internalizing or externalizing problems. So we found no effect there. So the mediation model where we thought maybe there would be a mediation. So inhibitory control would somehow predict internalizing and externalizing problems through its effects on emotion regulation. But we didn't find anything in terms of that. but we did find that general emotion regulation at 6 predicted both internalizing and externalizing problems 3 to 4 years later. So that's sort of the main findings.
Okay. So you didn't find the link with the inhibitory control, but you did find the link with the emotional regulation.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How are you interpreting those findings?
Yeah. So, I mean, what we see here is that if we just look at the emotion regulation findings, we see that children who were better at regulating emotions at 6, they showed fewer problems, fewer internalizing and externalizing problems at 9 to 10 years. But inhibitory control, we did measure inhibitory control very early. So it might be that it was sort of difficult to find that association. We did predict some, we did expect some sort of predictive signal, but it could be the fact that there's this long interval that perhaps the inhibitory control, maybe if we would find a sample with more issues with inhibitory control, that maybe we would find this association. Could also be that because we use this task, even though it is pretty well established, it could be that it didn't really capture inhibitory control reliably enough to sort of detect these longitudinal association. It also could, there are very many different reasons why this happened, really.
Were there any aspects of those results that you kind of found particularly surprising that you didn't expect?
I would say that not finding this association between inhibitory control and emotion regulation, and then also later mental health outcomes, was maybe the most surprising fact. Based on prior research, we would have expected to find those associations. So that was surprising.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that as well. Kind of like, were the findings kind of inconsistent with other findings in the area?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, we went into this basically looking at previous research that said that inhibitory control was sort of, I would say, consistently related to externalizing problems. And then there was some mixed findings in terms of internalizing problems. So we did expect to find these associations. And we also did expect, theoretically, to find something between inhibitory control and emotion regulation, because those are theoretically very much related. So it was quite surprising.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. So what's the research telling us? How are you interpreting this?
So I mean, we did in this study, we were able to sort of include both internalizing and externalizing problems in the same model, which is not always done. So usually we see research that is only predicting internalizing or only predicting externalizing. So here we could look at both of those at the same time. So what we did see is that emotion regulation is this sort of maybe a transdiagnostic developmental factor. So it's relevant to both internalizing and externalizing trajectories.
Okay, so focusing on that then, so like what would that, what would that mean? Like just thinking about kind of like for practitioners, maybe in a nursery or a school, what were the kind of key signs that kind of people should look for in those kind of day-to-day kind of behaviors of children?
Yeah, so I mean, it does tell us that emotion regulation around this age, so 6 years at school entry, it's a meaningful signal to look at. And if we see children that consistently struggle to regulate across multiple emotional contexts, so if we see children that have a hard time managing their emotions, who have a hard time calming down, this is something that we might need to look at. But of course, this is a modest sampled study, and it's also a community sample. So we need to maybe be careful about what we say based on this one study alone. But I think it definitely does tell us that it is a meaningful signal to attend to.
Sure. And then maybe thinking about this study with the kind of body of evidence that there is there a kind of emerging evidence base around the kind of most effective support interventions for strengthening those skills? How might that like look within a care system?
So there is, I would say that this research is, especially for children and youth, hasn't come very, very far. We do have some studies that are showing some very promising results in terms of just, you know, intervention for emotion regulation in general being, you know, a positive influence on mental health. So we do have these different methods. I think these interventions that exist right now are often based on methods from cognitive behavioral therapy, like emotion recognition and coping, regulation skills. And then we have mindfulness-based methods or acceptance methods, so accepting difficult emotions and working with them. But I think that one aspect that is very important to look at is what we call co-regulation, which is very important throughout childhood. So that is this ability of parents or teachers even to help support children in regulating emotions. So that means warmth and acceptance of the child's emotions and also directed coaching on how to deal with them. But we do have we need more research on targeted interventions, I would say. There is some evidence that it does help.
I was actually thinking about that as you were speaking, and I'm kind of curious about what the next steps might be in this kind of research field, especially in relation to that kind of global rise in mental health issues. What do you think this kind of research could potentially lead?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that when we find something like this, like a transdiagnostic predictive role of a factor like emotion regulation here in later mental health, I think it's really interesting that we find it in this community sample. So this is not a clinically recruited sample. So it kind of makes a case for these universal approaches for intervention. So helping basically everyone, trying to make sure that everyone gets these sort of interventions or at least some sort of education around emotion regulation. But those would need to be thought through very well, because we know that, for example, if we think about school-based approaches, like if we were to take an entire school and teach them emotion regulation or use mindfulness and things like that, that doesn't always work. And some of them actually can have negative effects on some children. But I do think that based on the previous research on caregivers being so important for children's emotion regulation, we might want to invest in parenting support, high quality early education, teacher training, and also reducing stressors in family lives that affect their functioning.
Have you got any further research lined up, either yourself, with the colleagues you're working with, or through the university that kind of explores these issues in more depth?
I would say that, like, not me in particular, but I do work with Emma Hammann, who is one of the co-authors on this paper. And she has been working a lot on emotion regulation and the effects of emotion regulations on different outcomes, and also on, for example, the sort of influence of the home environment on children's emotion regulation skills. We don't have any research right now here on emotion regulation interventions, but I think that would be a very interesting direction to take this.
Yeah, brilliant. Mm-hmm. We're coming to the end of the podcast. I'm just wondering whether there's like a kind of take-home message for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very important to think about what we can do to sort of help children with their emotion regulation, because it's not just this social skill that children have. It appears to be a very meaningful factor in whether they sort of go on to develop behavioral and emotional difficulties. So we should be mindful of watching that and being able to try to support that. And I would also say that these results sort of maybe tell us that we should invest in conditions that allow them to develop these skills. So helping families be able to support their children. Yeah. And also from a research perspective, which is a little bit more technical, the fact that we didn't find anything, that we had null effects there with inhibitory control, development is really, really complex. So often when we think about these, you know, minor things that are supposed to predict something much later, this can be very difficult to measure and very difficult to find. So I think it's also very important to publish null results so that we know what's going on in the field and that we know how to proceed.
Lily, it's been lovely speaking to you. I really enjoyed the kind of conversation.
Oh, you too. Thank you.
It was great to speak to Lily. Some really fascinating insights. It was really useful to hear how emotional regulation in early childhood might be such an important piece of the kind of mental health puzzle, and how it could kind of shape how we think about support in schools, homes, and also in services. And I guess as a kind of like final reflection from me, it was also a reminder of how important it is to publish all kinds of findings, so including ones that don't show strong effects, so we can build that kind of honest and realistic picture of what's actually happening in children's development. So once again, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel, search ACAMH, and you'll find us across social media. Join me next week and I'll be speaking to Melody Altshuler as we discuss her research on positive developmental cascades.